This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
And thank you all for joining us this evening. This evening is not a shiur, and it's certainly not a lecture or anything like that. It's really a conversation that I wanted to have with people to test your response to my preposterous suggestions about education, and just to hear from you as much as for you to hear from me. And the reason that I wanted to do this, and the reason that why it came to me, is that as one develops and evolves, or as some people say, grow older, one looks at the world differently, and the world is different. The world changes. And sometimes I meet people who used to listen to my shiurim, you know, 10 years ago or 15 years ago or 20 years ago, and they're still stuck almost like a fossil where I was 20 years ago. And that's part of the reason that I started the website, is that people could keep up with the evolution of thought. And while the old shiurim are still found to be extremely relevant, and I'm very thankful for that, we do have a lot of people joining iAwaken every day from countries as weird as Vietnam and Malaysia, and not weird, just unusual, parts of the old USSR, just people around the world, many of them Rabbonim, Rosh Yeshivas, and Mechanchim, who are using the Shirim of 30 years ago, and many of them communicate with me, and that's very wonderful. So it's not as if anything that I said then is not relevant today, but things develop, it goes beyond that. And particularly in the field of education, there has been a seismic shift in the world that a lot of people haven't quite registered. And that impacts things such as education. And therefore, models of education that I would never have thought of proposing 20 years ago, or 10 years ago, or in fact even 5 years ago, I do propose now. And I'm not proposing this with the suggestion that you go home and radically change the educational programs of your children, but just to start a thought process, to start an analysis process, to start thinking about these things just a little bit differently. So my thesis is really one sentence long. That's all I've got to say to you. So one sentence. And the rest is just expansion and explanation and looking at some of the implications of it. My thesis is simply that education as we know it is obsolete. You don't need education anymore. That's the thesis. Teachers should redefine their jobs. They don't have jobs anymore. And that happens in many industries. You know, the old printers, they used to have these typesetters, and the printing people used to print the newspapers every day, used to sit and typeset. And then computers came along, and smart kids out of college could just do it on an Apple Mac in a couple of minutes. And what did they have to do? They had to find new roles for themselves. They had to redefine their jobs. They had to re-educate themselves. And I would suggest that teachers, the role of teaching as we traditionally know it, I'm not talking about Torah, we'll come to Torah later. I'm talking about general. It's important to understand what's happening in the general world first, and then one can apply it to the Torah. And therefore, teachers of general information, that job that we used to know called teaching, that no longer is needed. We don't need those teachers anymore. Their jobs should be declared obsolete, and they should be put into pension, or they should be retrained, and prepare themselves for a different profession. That doesn't mean their profession won't involve the education of children, but not using the paradigms that they were trained to use. And that's where we need to get our thinking right. And you see, the reason for that is that, and here I'm quoting from an amazing man called Mark Perensky, who's researched some of this stuff already in 2001. In 2001, he was saying this, and he was considered off the wall, still considered off the wall by many. He's an inventor of computer games and an amazing business thinker. Not just business thinker, just a thinker and a thought leader and author. And he was writing papers at that time already, and he said the students of today are no longer the people for whom the educational system was designed to educate. So we're still using an educational system to design a group of people that no longer exist. And we keep on and we keep on and we keep on. Now, ultimately, it will change because eventually the universities will change, the postgraduate programs will change, and when the postgraduate program, they're already changing. When the postgraduate programs change, the undergraduate programs will start changing to feed into the postgraduate programs, and then the schools will start changing to feed into the university. But that's going to take 20 years. In the meantime, we are miseducating, or missing the opportunity of educating an entire generation. But again, the purpose of the discussion is not so much to discuss educational models for the world. It's for our own children. What do we do? And I think that the important thing to realize, as I'm teaching in business a lot at the moment, is you, and by you I mean anybody over 25, are the tail end of a species that will never exist again. And that's what we've got to get into our heads. There will never ever be a species like us. It's over, gone with, finished. The end of it. When we start getting that into our head, we can start understanding the world. As long as we think that our species is continuing, we're going to continue educating people to be like us. And you know what? This is the first time in history, I believe, that across the board, our children have no interest in being like us. It's the last thing they want to know. They have no ambition to be like us. They have no desire to be like us. And they have no intention of being like us. It's the first time that even little kids don't want to be like daddy when they grow up. That's one thing they know for sure. They do not want to be like dad when they grow up. And what does that mean, and why is that? Well, firstly, it's the first generation, I think, ever, where children know more than their parents in an area that's crucial for the future. So we've lost our power. We used to be able to say, we've got to teach you a whole lot of stuff because you've got to prepare for the teacher. You've got to prepare for the future. Thank you. The stuff we've got to teach them is not stuff relevant to them. We actually don't know anything about the future. They know about the future. They have a far clearer picture of the future than we do. So what are we going to teach them? And they know that. They know that we don't have a clue. They know we're clueless. Now, children always thought that their parents weren't very with it and their parents weren't cool. And you know, you had the normal teenager kind of thing, and then the kids would grow up and they would eventually come round to the fact, you know what, my father and mother, they weren't so bad after all. And then they start doing the same things with their children. What I'm suggesting to you is that pattern has stopped, at least for this generation. It might kick in again from here onwards. But the interface between the generation of the 25-year-old plus and 25-year-old minus, in that interface, that process isn't taking place. They're not going to grow up to eventually come to the conclusion and say, gee, you know, my dad was really quite bright. Well, they'll understand that he was bright in certain ways, and he was good in his area and his time maybe, but not that they're going to start reliving the same process and the same education that the parents have. Firstly, they have competencies that the parents don't have. Now, they get a new cell phone, they know how to use it. They don't have to look at a manual. Now that might sound just like a silly thing. So we still have to look at manuals. It's not even a question of have to look at manuals. The test is, do you look at manuals? Do you even check the box for a manual? If you do, you're an over 25-year-old. Because under 25-year-olds don't read manuals. They don't need manuals because they think like the technology. It's natural for them. For them, looking like for a manual would be like for you looking for a manual when you come into your house. Where do you switch on the lights? Where's the manual? Where do you switch on the lights? You kind of know where the light switches are. They're not on this side, they're on that side. You move into a new house or you go into a new hotel suite. You don't need a manual. Some of the hotel suites today, you do need a manual. But young kids don't. It takes them two minutes of experimenting. So they think like the technology. They don't think outside of technology and then apply their outside brains to try and figure out how to do something inside. They're in it. They think that way. So it's completely natural to them. And additional to that, they're not afraid to experiment. They're not afraid to try and make mistakes. And they learn quicker that way. So they'll get into there, buy a new program for their computer, or they'll buy a new telephone, or a new video machine, and they'll start messing around with it. And they'll get it wrong. You know, when we get a message on our computer, fatal error, you know, about to explode, we kind of go into panic. They just press OK and you're on to the next one. And they figure out. They're not fazed by it. These things don't faze them. They understand how it works. They understand what's going on. So there's a competency, a technological competency, which we don't have and won't get. Mark Perensky uses a brilliant phrase to describe the difference. He calls them digital natives, and he calls us digital immigrants. And he says, immigrants do eventually learn a new language, but they always speak with an accent, and they never know the exact right word, and they're always asking people to help them. And that's how we are. We're immigrants. We're immigrants into technology. They are native to technology. They're born into it. And therefore, he claims, by the way, joining the school that today is widely spread of the neuroplasticity of the brain, that the brain actually over a period of time, and we're not talking about generations, we're talking about weeks, actually rewires itself, that the brain restructures itself. And he says that he's not quite sure yet whether there's actually a different brain structure. His subsequent writing seems to suggest that there is a different brain structure, but there are certainly what he calls different patterns of thinking process. So the digital natives, the under 25-year-olds, have a different thinking process. At least they have that. They might have different brain structure, but they certainly have a different thinking process. So they have competencies that we have that we don't have. They know more than we do in areas that become very important. They don't really want to they don't want to be like their parents. The idea of a linear career is something that they can't figure out. The idea of getting a job and then working for 30 years until you kind of get yourself to senior management. But they don't want to be managers. They have no desire for managers. So it's quite interested in motivating people. You know, one of the things we use is promotion. They're not interested in promotion. They're not interested in corporate structures. They're not interested in climbing the ladders. It doesn't turn them on at all. I say them, I'm generalizing. There are some that do. But generally speaking, they don't want to be involved in a corporate ladder. Why would they want that? One in four workers have been in jobs that they've been in for less than 1 year. And it kind of stays that way. They job hop, they move, they don't want to sit and build a career. They don't believe that you have to build wealth in a linear fashion. In fact, they're not linear at all. Their idols are the people who've become instantly wealthy, who are their own age. Now, I'm not only talking about the owners of places like Google and thousands of others like them. You know, we know the kind of famous ones, but those aren't the only ones. There are thousands and thousands of entrepreneurs who've become very, very wealthy very, very quickly, building their own little businesses into big little businesses. But not even that. If you look on television, all these programs of these youngsters that become instantly famous because they go into some talent program and they've got a bit of a voice and somebody notices them and packages them and promotes them, they understand that it's possible to leapfrog. You don't have to go through the process. And their ambition is to leapfrog. Now, some of them won't make it. Some of them will fail. And when they fail, maybe they'll have to go into a linear process. Maybe they won't. Maybe they'll do the same as they do when they're playing with a new program. They'll fail a few times, start a few times, and eventually hit it right and be okay. Who knows what will be? It's too early to know what failure will look like in this period or in this era. But one thing is for sure, they don't have the patience or the desire or the value system to work their way up something or other. That's not the way they do it. They understand that if you find the key, you can leapfrog to the destination. You don't have to go through process. And that's the biggest difference between, I like to call them Generation E. He calls them digital natives, and that's fine. But he's operates primarily in the digital industry, and I want to take the thinking way out of the digital industry. So I like to call them Generation E people, and E being exponential. They think and live exponentially, not in a linear fashion. They don't recognize linearity as a means, as the normal method of causality. They understand exponential leap. They understand you can be here 1 minute, and a minute later you can be in a completely different space, and you don't have to go through all the steps to get there. We're still saying, you've got to go through the steps, and you can't do that before you've done this. You know? And they just look at us, and they know we're wrong. They know we're wrong because they've got enough experience of people that they've read about, heard about, seen, know, friends, and their own little experiences that teach them that isn't so at all. So the idea of linear careers, of linear wealth building doesn't apply to them. They're not really that materialistic, contrary to what most people think. They're much more interested in freedom than in material possession. Many of them don't want to be bogged down with material possession. They want to be free to move. They want the capacity to be able to buy whatever they want. That they want, but they don't want the things. that much. Certain things they want and they crave for. And they don't get attached to things. They buy things, they sell them again. That's why eBay does so well. It's a marketplace of things that people buy for a short while and then get rid of and somebody else buys them. So things circulate. Remember in the old days you used to buy furniture that lasted. Why? They can't get it. Why would you want furniture that lasts? In a few years' time, you're not going to want the same furniture that you want now. You're not going to be the same person. Why would you want the same furniture? So you want furniture that's stylish, that is cheap enough to buy and to get rid of after a few years, enjoy it, and then get something new. So our whole relationship to things is very, very different. And if you think about it for a moment, so what changes? Think about it in the area of employment, because the area of parenting, educating and employment are all linked. We used to parent, educate and employ in the knowledge that the power was with the parent, the educator or the employer. That's no longer true. The power is not with, let's start with the employer. The power is not with the employer. At the moment, if you're looking about young talent, you're looking about bright young people. I'm not talking about the nachschleppers. Nachschleppers you'll always have, they'll always need jobs, you'll always hire them, they'll do the slave work. Not talking about that. They're not the factor that you really need in a business today. What you really need in a business today is bright young talent. Because those people are going to be, firstly, they're going to be your customers of tomorrow. Quite apart from the fact that you're going to employ them, they're actually going to be your customers of tomorrow. So now you take this bright young talent, they don't need your job because they believe they can make money without your job. In fact, they can probably make more money without your job. And if you don't give them a job, there are 100 others that do. And they don't have to be looking for jobs in this country. Where do you think they look for jobs? They look for jobs on the internet. And they're finding jobs all over the world. So it's not like you're living in a little village and there are 10 jobs and you own 4 of them, so you kind of hold the power. You don't hold any power at all when you're trying to employ talent. You're trying to employ bright, talented young people, people of this generation. We don't hold any power. So we've got to start looking at employees, and we need them. Everybody knows that the secret to tomorrow is that kind of talent. Because you've got to design technologies for tomorrow. It's quite interesting that the top 10 jobs in 2010 didn't exist in 2004. Just think of that. 2004 was 6 years earlier. We were busy educating people for 2010. So the meaning of that really is that we're currently preparing students for jobs that don't yet exist. They don't exist. We don't know what we're preparing them for. You're going to be a this when you're big. I don't know what you're going to be when you're big, because when you're big, the job you're going to have doesn't exist at the moment. So how can I prepare you? And the kid knows that. And they'll be using technologies that aren't yet invented. So we're training them for jobs that don't exist, to use technologies that aren't invented to solve problems that we don't even know are problems yet. That's the insufficiency of education. We used to be able to prepare people for jobs that existed, to use technologies that we can teach them now how to use tomorrow to solve problems that are problems now and will be tomorrow. That's not so anymore. The problems of tomorrow aren't yet problems. The technologies to solve them don't yet exist. And the jobs in which they'll work also don't exist. So what are we training them for? And yet we need to have people who can think in that space. So this young talent now becomes the crucial ingredient of business success in most industries. And more it's becoming the crucial ingredient. So how do you now treat an employee? What model would you use to treat an employee? You're now hiring a bright 19-year-old, doesn't have a university degree, just out of school, brilliant with technology. You see that he's talented, you want him. How do you treat him? You treat him like a customer. Because he's as free to move around as a customer is. So the old model of an employee doesn't exist anymore. For talent, again, I'm talking about talent. So I would suggest that the old model of an employer-employee doesn't exist anymore. The power is with him. Just as we have come to realize that the power is with the customer, and if the customer isn't taken good care of, the customer goes elsewhere, so the employee, and it doesn't matter if the customer's young or the customer's old, doesn't matter if the customer's knowledgeable or not, if you treat the customer in a way that you know better than him or her, you lose the customer. So one of the things you need to use, one of the middos that you need to use when you're dealing with a customer, and you learn that in business very quickly, is anova. You've got to have humility to be able to treat an ordinary person who is a customer in a way where that person feels choshev, that person feels important. That's kind of the aleph beis of customer service. Now we've got to do that with employees too. So now you've got to take this young guy, you've worked your entire life to get where you are, he's just joined, you're paying him, and you've got to treat him like he's a customer. Because he's free to move and you need him, he doesn't need you. That's what we've got to start getting into our head. That's a major paradigm shift. An educator, when it comes to an educator, also the power was with the teacher. I'm going to teach you things that you don't know. That's not true anymore. What does the teacher know that the child can't find out? A bright technology child. What knowledge does the teacher have that the child doesn't have? Well, yes, in certain areas, and we'll come to that, there are certain areas where there's knowledge and wisdom that a teacher can have, if the teacher is really wise. But if all the teacher has is knowledge, then the child has quicker access to that knowledge than the teacher could possibly teach to the child. So what's the power of the teacher? It's interesting, there was an organization here in South Africa that was running a series of courses, and they put together the best of those courses into a very contracted, kind of like a little mini MBA, and they brought their bright young stars from around the world. So they got them from all over the world, these bright young under 25 years old, these digital natives or e-geners, and they brought them out here for that course. And when I met this organization, they'd just been given the course on networking by a woman who's apparently an international expert in networking. And she was almost in tears. She said they are the rudest, most disgusting generation of people she's ever had to come across. She's disappointed in this organization for considering them the stars. There's nothing star quality about them. They're a bunch of dropouts. And she really doesn't want to teach them again. So I said, that's interesting. And the organization was confused because they knew these guys are stars. So I said, well, that's very interesting. Why? What was her problem? Oh, they told me these kids were on the internet, they were on their cell phones, they were SMSing each other, they were Blackberrying each other, they were on Facebook, they were doing all sorts of stuff while she was talking, and she couldn't get their attention. I said, and what did you say she was teaching them? They said, networking. And I said, and what were they doing while she was teaching them? They were busy networking across the globe, using a language they had invented, which people of another culture, another part of the world, were able to understand. And she, a 50-year-old woman, is teaching these kids networking. You know, when you go to a cocktail party, this is how you kind of connect with people. But is that what they need to know? So if we still insist on defining networking as what you do when you go to a cocktail party, then I suppose we've got something to teach them. But that's not networking anymore. Who do you meet at a cocktail party? The 10 people who live close to you? Or the 50 people who live close to you? What can they really offer you? Networking, you want to network across the globe. You don't want to network in a small area. Do you know that if MySpace was a country, it would be the 11th largest country in the world? That's where they network. They don't network at a cocktail party with, you know, 25 other old people who've got nothing else to do on a Wednesday night or whenever they get together. That's not where they network. And we sometimes think that they're not socializing. But of course they're socializing. It's no different to the old lady. He says, you know, and then when the telephone was invented, you know, when we were young, you wanted to talk to your neighbors, you went across and you sat on the stoop and you talked to your neighbor. And what people do now, they pick up the phone. Is that called socializing? And we say, yes, but with the phone we can socialize with people we could never meet before. So true, the quality of socializing with our next door neighbor has deteriorated, but the quantity of socializing has exponentially improved. And look at exactly the same is happening now with technology. So the kids' quality of socializing might not be as deep, although one can even question that, as it used to be. But look at how many, look at the skills of socializing that they're developing and their ability to develop those techniques. So when it comes to education, we've got to question what it is that we're teaching children, that they can't access themselves, that they can't learn themselves. And as teachers, what respect do we really command? If the power is no longer with the teacher, it's as Mark Perensky says, it's like bringing an immigrant to teach a child a language that the child is a native in. So yes, the teacher may know the grammatical rules and things that the child can't articulate, but the child speaks grammatically correctly and the teacher doesn't. The teacher speaks with an accent and the child doesn't. So in a digital sense, we've got to really understand that what we're trying now to teach the children is we're teaching them using a language that we don't really speak. And it's very difficult for the children to respect that type of teaching. And what about parenting? Parenting, you've got the same issue. Kids can no longer be controlled. In the old model, you could control your employee, and you could control your student, and you could control your kids. We now live in a world where they have control. You might think you have control, and they might be bright enough to keep you thinking that you've got control, but you don't have control. A kid can take his or her head anywhere they want to, anywhere in the world, in a second. And if it's not in your house because your internet is locked away or you don't have internet, it's in their friends' houses or at internet cafes or using PDAs, borrowing a PDA from a friend, using a PDA, fancy cell phone. In seconds, their heads can be wherever you want them to be. So you can't control that. The only thing you can control your children with now is a value system. That's all. And trust. There's no rules are going to control them. How are rules going to control them? To get some idea of what's going on, and many of you know this, 2.7 billion searches on Google every month. This was a couple of years ago, the number's much bigger now. 2.7 billion searches on Google. Some of those searches are your children's, because that's just the natural place, that's the place that they go to. 1 in 8 couples in the United States in 2004, it's much higher now. 1 in 8 couples, married couples, met on the internet. It's amazing. That's where it is. That's the marketplace. That's the meeting place. There are more SMSs sent daily than there are people in the world. Every day, there are more SMSs sent than there are people in the entire world. That's the level of connectivity and interaction between people. What are we going to control our children in a world like that? We sound so idiotic when we even use the words, when we even talk about control. They realize straight away we're dinosaurs. Thinking of control and discipline, all it doesn't exist. Can't exist. It just can't exist. Doesn't mean it was a bad thing when it did exist. Just can't now. You know how many new books are published every day? Take a guess. Every day. How many new books published every day? 3,000. Every single day, 3,000 new books. That's the level of and most of them are available on the internet. So what do we do about all this? So the first thing that I'm arguing is education, as we know it, is obsolete. You don't need most of the stuff you learn at school. And the question is why we would then subject our children to a learning process and a learning methodology. Why are you teaching children to remember stuff? What on earth do they need to remember it for? When they can access it. It's changing that quickly. You actually don't. It's not even good to remember stuff, because the stuff that's stuck in your brain doesn't apply anymore. So now you're remembering stuff from goodness knows when, which is all irrelevant. You want to be able to move quickly. You want to be able to access new stuff. And why are we educating them during all of that time and stuff that they don't really need? Let's look at some of the characteristics of these new generation people. Of the way they learn, the way they think. And here again I'm referring to Mark Perensky's research to try and figure out what is unique about the way they learn. And this is really, really fascinating. And when you understand this, you'll see the Yad Hashem in all of this. What are the characteristics? There are four characteristics, or there are three primary characteristics that he identifies in their cognitive structures and the way they structure their thinking. The first thing is hypertext. The way of moving through information is not the way we used to move through information, where you would go through in some kind of linear fashion, look up something in an index, read the piece, close the book away, put it away, go to the next thing on your list that you want to. They work with information, and we're getting into that too, but not to the same extent that they are. They work with information as you would explore a new mountain path. You're going off for a walk and you're exploring. What do? You say, no, we decided we're going on this path. Yeah, but there's a beautiful view just off over there. Sorry, we're not into that view. We're not doing that. We're on the path. You don't do that. You go off and you have a look at the view and you admire the view. And while you're there, you notice there's a pathway down. So you take that way a little bit down and you notice an interesting flower and you want to look at the flower. All of a sudden, you're off on a different path altogether. That doesn't bother you. It's an outing. Who cares where you land up? It's not about the destination. And that's how these children will work with information. They explore an infinite body of exploration, of information. As adults, I don't know if we fully understand that almost all of human knowledge is a fingertip away. Never been in such a time before. It's just incredible that there's probably nothing that you need to know that you can't get in an instant on the end of a computer. The full body of human knowledge is available to anybody, anywhere, instantly. And our method of exploring that is by hypertexting. It's not by a linear process of going through information. It's interesting that the Harvard Business School, and Harvard University generally, but Harvard Business School is where I know it for a fact, regards its biggest competitor as the University of Phoenix. The University of Phoenix is an online university. So they realized already, and I heard this from them 2 years ago, more than 3 years ago, they realized already that their biggest competition is not from other campus universities. That doesn't mean there's no value in a campus university, but it's not necessarily the thing of the future. The method of learning would be learning through technology. So the first thing is hypertexting. The second thing is that their cognitive structures, he says, are parallel, not sequential. They're holding a number of thought processes in their mind simultaneously. The dinosaurs call that ADD. they and kind of give them all sorts of medication so as to stop doing the stuff, you know, just kind of just be normal like we used to be when we were kids and concentrate on one thing at a time. They can't. They can't do that. They're not wired that way. I'm not suggesting that there isn't such a clinical thing and that there aren't conditions that need medication. There are. But the reason that there's been an exponential increase in ADD is because we're dealing with digital natives, not with digital immigrants. Of course they don't. That's not how they think. They do six things at one time. They get bored if they're doing one thing at a time because a whole part of their brain is not being utilized. They're wired that way. They can do that. And we say, but concentrate. And they say, but we are. And then you say, but you can't be concentrating. You're on your cell phone. And I said, but still, I heard everything you say. I'll just repeat it to you. You said, I can't be concentrating. I'm on my cell phone. And they can repeat it exactly. They can. Is that the best way to concentrate? You can argue, it's just a fact. It's not a question of philosophy, whether this is the way it should be or it shouldn't be, or we want it to be or we don't want it to be. We first got to just understand what is. Then we can figure out what we want to do about it. But what is that they operate with parallel rather than sequential cognitive structures. They're able not only to do and to concentrate on different things at once, they can think along parallel lines simultaneously. And they can think vertically across those lines. Like kind of like a spreadsheet. So they're thinking there are all sorts of things in place and they're looking at various different relationships as they go through that thought process. And we find that very difficult to do if we can do it all together. And the second element of their cognitive structures is immediate interactivity. So they used to be able to interact. And a lot of it is programmed by video games. That's why this guy, Mark Perensky, comes from such an interesting place because he designs video games for education as well as for play. But he claims that a lot of the rewiring of the young people's brain is a function of video games. And in video games, there's an immediate interactivity. So just to sit and stare at a book that does nothing back to you, that's not how they learn. They learn interactively. They interact with the information. And that's the way they learn, and that's the way their cognitive structure functions. So those are the three areas. Hypertext, parallel or rather than sequential cognitive structures, and extreme hyperactivity, interactivity. The missing piece is the capacity to reflect. Just to sit quietly and think about something. That they find very difficult. And that's a serious missing piece. And there haven't been any suggested solutions for that yet. Here's the fascinating thing. Hypertexting. What is Gemara? What is the thinking process of Gemara? It's hypertext. That's how you move around. Try and find some linear sequence of the way a perek of Gemara is structured. It's difficult enough to understand why the mesechtas are in their particular areas and the sequence of one from the other. And the first Tosfos of many mesechtas starts off saying, why this here? And usually comes up with quite a strange answer that isn't really a sequential linear answer. You've got to get into it in a much more exponential way to understand the sequence even of mesechtas. Certainly of Mishnayos, one after the other. Why does this Mishnah follow the other? And then when you get into why are these pieces of Gemara in this particular Mishnah, and what is the relationship between this one and that one, it's not linear. This is hypertexting. While we're on this, by the way, you know, you mentioned that word. Well, there's something over here that has a similar... What is a Gezeirah Shavah? Is a Gezeirah Shavah not hypertexting? Now here's a word, chin, somewhere else in the Torah in a completely unrelated area, you find the same word, so let's start putting them together and start figuring things out from one another. Is that not parallel cognitive structuring? Is that not what a Gezeirah Shavah is? And we sit there and think, now, how do you understand a Gezeirah Shavah? You cannot understand a Gezeirah Shavah if you're thinking along linear sequence. It doesn't make any sense. You cannot understand the build-up of a sugya of Gemara if you're thinking of linear structure. And what about interactivity? How do we learn? With the Chavrusa. So we don't have technological interactivity, but you have human interactivity. So you say something, there's a response. You ask something, there's an answer. You give an answer, there's another question. There's constant interactivity. And that's one of the requirements of learning, is that you learn with Chavrusa, that you learn in a group, that you learn with a Rebbe, so that it's interactive. So look at what's happened. The world has taken these number of thousands of years to come around to a thinking process which we have trained ourselves not to be in through our secular education, and the thinking process that these young kids are coming around to by playing video games is more aligned to the thinking process of Gemara and of Torah than any thinking process has ever been in the past. So where does that lead us? That leads us to saying, let's now get into the Torah area. Now I say, really, education as we know it is obsolete. What's the point? What is a kid going to learn in secular education that he's not going to learn in Torah education that he needs for tomorrow? I didn't think I would ever hear myself saying that. Because things were different not so many years ago. But that's how things are today. If you look at what a child is going to need for tomorrow, all he's going to need are four things. A thinking process, which is not linear, and which is hypertexting, and which involves parallel cognitive structures, which is interactive. He needs that thinking process. He needs English. He needs the capability of accessing information and expressing information. So he needs to be able to read, write, and speak English. And he needs maths. That's what he needs. And the maths that he needs is not the maths that they've been teaching for years and years. It's a different approach. Same material. It's not so much that they need that the material has to be different. It's that the teaching process has to be different. What he needs as my young E. Jenner son says, maths is just understanding how numbers work. It's just really understanding how numbers behave, the relationship between numbers, and you can work the rest out when you understand that principle. And so all a kid really needs to learn is how to do that. Now that's a lot of learning. That's not simple learning, a lot of learning. How the child is going to learn that in this age might be a very different way from the way that he learned it before. But one thing is clear, is he needs maths. If we're looking at this future world into which these children are moving, they're going to need mathematics. They're going to need English. Do you know that China is going to be the number one English-speaking language, the English-speaking country in the world, I think in 5 years' time? The speed at which they're getting their hand around English as the international language of communication. So you need to be able to communicate, and you need to be able to communicate well. That's a competitive edge. Looking at a young talent, you get a young person who knows how to access information and how to articulate ideas and thoughts. That's very, very valuable. So if you want to give a child an edge in the world, communication skills are really, really crucial. We're failing in that area in schools. We're not giving great communication skills. They're not coming out of schools, orators and communicators on a one-on-one level. They're not coming out that way. And that's what they really need. And they need to be able to read. They need to have an understanding of language, a feel for language, a use of imagery. The other area in language that is so interesting is literature. Because through literature, they're developing some of their right brain activities. So it's not just language from a scientific perspective and from a grammatical perspective, but the use of language in poetry and literature, so that they're developing their right brain activities as well. They need English, they need maths, they need curiosity. And that's all you need in secular education. If your kid was a star in maths, world-class maths, had a world-class mathematical education, had a world-class English education, and had an insatiable curiosity, what would they not know? What do they have to learn more than that? Nothing. There's nothing they can't teach themselves after that. There's nothing they can't learn themselves after that. That's all they need. Add to that all the things that are really becoming important, that capacity to hypertext, to parallel think, and to think interactively, that they get from Torah. There's something else they get from Torah. They get to think exponentially, which is part of the same thing. So when you think in Torah, it's not linear, it's not 1 and 1 plus equals 2, you're thinking exponentially. You think in a way that I call spherical. You kind of think with a core principle, and you move out in all directions simultaneously to build the next ring. And then you move out in all directions simultaneously to build the next ring. That's why it takes so long to learn a page of Gemara. That's why you can't turn Gemara pages as quickly as you can turn the pages of Encyclopedia Britannica. Because in each page, you're moving in multiple directions to build your next ring of understanding. And then the next one, each one's getting bigger and bigger as you build it. That's how you think in Gemara. That's how kids are needing to think for the future. But there's another thing that's interesting in Gemara, and that is that you develop right brain and left brain capacity simultaneously, and I don't know of another study that does that, maybe music, that enables you to develop analytical linear thinking simultaneous with exponential right brain thinking capability. Because you can't understand Gemara if you're only in left brain. You can't grow in Gemara if you're only in left brain. And you certainly can't if you're only in right brain. It's actually at the fusion of both that you understand the essence of a sugya. You can only really get to the core of a piece of Gemara if you've intersected right and left brain capability and you're thinking exponentially. So what better way is there to learn how to think for the future than Gemara and top it up with English and maths? And that solves a huge problem, because in the old days, the question was, how do you achieve excellence in secular and in Torah? To become a world-class Talmid Chacham, you need full-time learning. To become a world-class secular expert, you need full-time learning. How do you take a kid and give him half a day of Limudei Kodesh and half a day of Limudei Chol, and you then want some extramural activities and some sports, and you want them to be good at everything? That's been very difficult for kids, and hasn't been very successful. There have been pockets of success. There have been individuals that have been successful. But to say generally we've been successful in educating people who are great in both, that's not really so. But that can change now, because you don't need all that time for secular education. So I'm now suggesting that in fact the old model of cheder education is probably the right model, topped up with world-class maths and English and the building up of incredible curiosity, and giving the child a computer terminal with the value system to be able to handle that in a way that doesn't have to be controlled and disciplined. That's where the focus should be. Now, it's not as simple as it sounds, because Gemara teachers, unfortunately, aren't trained to teach Gemara that way. Gemara teachers are teaching Gemara in the dinosauric way. They're still teaching Gemara for yesterday. So we have to understand that there's a need to revolutionize the way we do this, just as we have to teach maths in a very different way. And we should even start teaching English in a very different way. We have to start teaching Torah in a very different way. Torah is no longer the transmission of information. It is that, but that's just a very small part of it. What it really now becomes is teaching people how to think in a way that they can manage the world in the area to which it's moving. And I'm talking about not only the area to which it's moving technologically, but the area to which it's moving spiritually. Because just as there is this unbelievable quantum speed developing in technology, where every 2 years we're kind of doubling the amount of information that there is in the world, exactly the same is happening spiritually. There is a quantum move forward in the world's spiritual understanding. And the only study, once again, that can equip a child to manage technology and spirituality at once is Torah. There's nothing else that has that. You can go into the Himalayas and study spirituality, or you can go and study Kabbalah on its own or whatever it is, and you get the spirituality. You can go and study maths and science and you get the technology. But what limud is there that equips the thinking process to deal with the spiritual and the technological at the same time? What process of learning is there that enables people to think linear and exponential at the same time, that enables people to think right brain and left brain at the same time, that enables people to think spiritual and analytical at the same time? There isn't another process that allows that facilitates that to happen. So I would argue that not only do we now have the opportunity to achieve excellence in our educational systems, but we in fact have an educational model that exceeds the capacity of any other educational model in the world. That if we would start using our power of education in our schools and yeshivas, we could equip people to handle the future in ways that no other educational institution could possibly do if we get our teachers to start reprogramming themselves, the way they teach, the way they teach Gemara, the way they teach various other aspects of Limud HaKodesh. Let's take the one area of difficulty that they identify with the digital natives. We said that the area of difficulty was reflection. They don't have time to reflect. Take a child in yeshiva and see him standing Shmona Esra. 3 times a day, he takes time out and learns how to slow down. If we teach him that, if we teach him how to babble away the davening at 50 miles an hour, then we're not giving him that opportunity. But if we teach him how to slow down in davening, and how to reflect, and how to meditate, and how to relax, how to focus his mind in a different space, then throw that into the mix. So now we've got Gemara with right and left brain capability, linear and exponential at the same time. We've given him world-class English and world-class maths because we can afford that now. We have the time and the money to do that because we don't need science teachers. We don't need geography teachers. We don't need all these other teachers. We don't need them. All we need is the best science teacher we can find or the best maths teacher we can find in the world and the best English teacher we can find in the world. Somebody that can inspire their curiosity in those fields and in every other field as well. That's what we need. And we need really good Gemara teachers. But we can now afford that. We've got the time for that because all they need to be doing are those 3 subjects. And davening. We teach them how to davening, we're giving them the missing piece. That's the ability to reflect. So when I say that the cheder route is the route to go, I'm not suggesting old-time chadorim. I think the chadorim also, and the yeshivas, need to look at new models of how to do it, and some are already dealing with that. And we've seen that throughout the ages. Chaim Soloveitchik revolutionized the way Gemara was taught. Completely revolutionized the thinking process. The substance stayed the same. He was teaching the same mesechtas, but he revolutionized the way the Torah was taught. The Torah was taught and the Torah was learnt. In the same way as the Alter of Slabodka revolutionized the way Musar was taught. Not that long after the introduction of Musar as a formal subject, as a formal practice. But whereas Musar until that time had been very disciplined and very, 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 very hard focused, Reb Nota Tzvi Finkel turned it around into a builder of self-esteem and self-worth. And he revolutionized the Limud HaMusar. Didn't change the topic, he didn't change the subject matter, didn't change the content, he changed the approach to it, the attitude to it, revolutionized it. It was right for the age. What Reb Chaim Soloveitchik did was revolutionize the learning and teaching of Torah. It was right for the age. And there's probably a need to do that again. But over a period of time, if we understand this enormous capability that we have through our access to Torah, we'll start developing new models of how to learn and how to teach Torah in a way that really suits the new generation and works with the new generation and liberates that level of human potential. As far as a teaching model generally is concerned, it's, again, we have it, the Seder. The Pesach Seder is the perfect learning model for digital natives. It's as if it was designed for the modern generation. That's the beauty. When I said you see the Yad Hashem, Hashem is rewiring the brains of humanity to make them open to receiving Torah. It's unbelievable. Without even trying, just kind of getting rewired. And the Ribbono Shel Olam is creating that capability and preparing us for what's happening, giving us the tools we're going to need for this very fast-changing environment in which we're operating. But if you look at the Seder as well, the Seder teaches such a simple educational technique, and you can use it not just with your own children, but use it in educating one another, because we're all educating one another all the time. And that is, there are only three modalities of education that work, certainly with this kind of person, but generally. The first is storytelling. People listen to stories, they hear stories. They don't fall asleep when you're telling a good story. And you know, people will say, the young generation, oh, that they don't have concentration, they don't have this. Not true. They can concentrate. People will say they don't have a work ethic. Not true. Go and see them working at Google and other such places. They can work like crazy if they're aligned with the work. Not that, that isn't the problem. And anybody, listening to a story is universal. So one of the ways of education is by storytelling. So in our Torah and English classes, we should not only be teaching people to read stories, we should be teaching people to write stories. We should be teaching people to tell stories, because that's going to be the way they're going to educate one another. Storytelling, powerful technique. We know how to do it. Every medrash is a story. The whole of Chumash and most of Tanakh is a story. We're raised on stories. But we're teaching stories as facts instead of teaching stories as art. So we're going to have to re-educate our teachers to start teaching the art of storytelling and the art of story reading. Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim is the art of storytelling. That's how you pass information down to the next generation. Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. The other way you can do it is by asking questions. When you ask somebody a question, you engage them. And we know what we do on the Seder night to get kids to ask questions. We just about turn somersaults to get kids to ask questions, because getting people to ask and asking. We ask questions and we get people to ask questions. When you ask a question, the channel of communication is open. Somebody asks you a question, you're listening. Answering a question that somebody asks, you're also listening. So those are the three modalities. Tell a story, ask a question, or answer a question. Don't tell people anything. They won't hear you. In today's environment, where there is such an overload of information, we actually turn that off. The telling stuff, we filter out. We don't hear it. And when you get to the young people who are wired differently, they're not capable of hearing. I told you so. When did you tell me? I've told you 10 times. No, you didn't. Yes, I did. No, you didn't. Yes, I did. Yeah, I told you 10 times. You didn't hear. Why? Because we're designed to tune telling out. We don't listen to that. Tell a story, I'll remember it. Answer my questions, I'll remember it. Ask me questions, I'll remember it. But I won't remember what you told me when I didn't ask you. That's part of the new way that we have to learn of communicating with people, we employ, people we educate, and children that we're raising, is to be able to tell them stories, ask them questions, and stimulate them to ask questions that enable us to answer them. That's what the Seder is about. Get the kid to ask the right questions, because if he's asking the right questions, he'll hear the answers. But if he hasn't asked anything, don't tell him. It's not going to do anything for your relationship, and it's not going to give him any information that he doesn't already know. Whereas when he goes onto Google, what's happening then? He's asking the questions. That's part of the brilliance of Google, to realize the way to access information is to ask questions, and then to make sure that you're able to provide them with the right answers. So there's some of my thinking on the topic, and I'm interested to hear your views. In summary, just saying that we're the end of a dead species, not a dying species. It's dead, it's gone. People will never think the way we think again. They'll never operate the way we operate again. And being therefore at the interface between where we are and that new generation makes things a little bit challenging and a little bit difficult, because the people we're educating are not the people that our educational systems are designed to educate. That we've got to understand that the young people today have power that they never had before. They have access to a way of thinking that we need and do not have. And it's something that we're going to learn as best we can, but we'll never learn it as well as they do. So we're going to have to establish partnerships with them rather than to try and control them. And if those partnerships are founded on trust and good values, we'll have relationships that we can influence. We'll never control, but we can influence. And that's really got to be one of the biggest shifts in the education of our own children, is to understand we can influence, and the better we are at communicating, the better we can influence them. Provided we have a system of values, we can control them only with a system of values, not with structures anymore. Structures don't exist, they don't work anymore. The thinking is outside of structures. That's its greatness and that's its weakness. That the role of education, therefore, as we've known, it doesn't really apply. We've got to look at a different model of education. The only things kids really need to know, maths, English, and have a good dose of curiosity. And Torah is perhaps the most perfectly positioned training. If we do it right, not the same old way, but if we revolutionize the way we teach our Torah, we can prepare our children for super competence in the next, in the future, in any field into which they want to go. Now, you don't have to prepare them. We've said already, we're training kids for jobs that don't exist, so we can't go into vocational training anymore. But giving children the capability to think, to access information, to articulate it and to analyze is all they really need. From there, they can then prepare themselves for anything they want to prepare themselves, and they can access anything they want to access. And in that all, we see the Yad Hashem leading us into an era where we will be able to manage the spiritual and the technical simultaneously, the analytical and the spiritual simultaneously, right brain and left brain, exponential and linear, and that's what the capacity we're going to need more than anything else as we prepare our young people for the next generation. So that's it, and I would like to hear what your response is.